multilingual use on the internet, as we are called, IDNs. In true democratic spirit, we've decided to speak English, all of us, because that's the way to go. It made things easier for all of us. I'm Anne-Marie Eklund Lewinder. I'm from .se. I work as a quality and security manager. And for .se, IDNs are very important for different reasons. Some of them will be discussed today. We are very anxious to make IDNs happen for the Swedish minority languages in the first place, and we are planning to do that next year. For the moment, you are not only allowed to use the Swedish diacritics like O, A, Ö, the German E, no, E accent, and the German Y. That's the way. So, we have three very, very skilled speakers, and I will start with introducing Tina Dam. Tina is IDN coordinator from ICANN, and I better leave to her to tell more about what ICANN is doing in this matter. Tina, welcome.
Thank you very much. So my name is Tina Dam. I'm from Denmark, as Anne-Marie said, we decided to take this in English, and I think maybe that's my fault because my Swedish is not that good. I lived in Los Angeles for the last getting close to 4 years. I started working at ICANN as their chief GTLD registry liaison, so I was working with the generic top-level domain registries. And then slowly, IDNs just became more and more important to us, so I transitioned over very recently into just the full IDN role. We're still hiring staff and so forth to make it a full program, but it's something that's very new within ICANN, is that we started working much more project-oriented. The goal is to be able to show our community and users of the internet a little bit more transparently what it is that we do every day. And one of those programs then has to do with IDNs. The goal, of course, with all of the projects within this one program is that we will be able to insert internationalized top-level labels in the root zone. It's a really exciting project to be a part of, but it's also a little bit difficult because it goes from technical to policy to politics, and it is a very broad spectrum of different things that need to be solved. But in any event, we're setting up this this program plan, and I'm the one who's a full-time staff on it so far. We're using some of our existing technical policy and IANA staff, and then we have a broad range of new positions open. So advertisement, if you know anybody who's interested and think this is as exciting as I think it is, you know, just send them my way. Goals with the program, of course, has to do with domain names, making domain names available in local scripts. And other than that, you'll hear me say probably several times during my presentation that we need to make sure that the internet continues staying secure and stable, and global interoperability is a really important aspect for us. Really what that means is that if I'm sending an email to one of you, it doesn't really matter where in the world I am when I send it, it will go to you and it won't go to someone else. It will go to you or it will fail, and I'll know if it's failing. Don't want to risk it going somewhere else. And the same thing goes with websites and other types of applications that take advantage of the use of domain names. And I know this is a little bit of a confusing slide, but I just wanted to give like a little bit of an overview. We used to have, in the beginning, only domain names that were based on ASCII, and it's what sometimes is referred to as the LDH rule. It's LDH stands for letter, digit, hyphen. Moving towards internationalized second-level and top-level domain names, But domain names is not really the only thing that we need to have in order to have what is usually referred to as an internationalized internet. We also need to have all of the applications available. And you may have seen that Internet Explorer just came out with version 7, and it's it can handle internationalized domain names. Mozilla Firefox and Opera and other applications have had that capability for some time, continuing to upgrade the way that things are working, though. And then the third thing there is content. And content on website has been available for some time in many languages, and the expectation is that that will continue to expand and help driving the market's need for the domain names as well. The example that test that I have up there is really just to show you, and the parentheses below is just to show you that the domain name system can't really handle all of these characters that are different than ASCII. ASCII is A through Z, 0 to 9, and the dash. And because it can't handle that, we have this way of decoding an IDN domain name into XN dash dash, and then a sequence of ASCII characters. The intent is that the user really never really should be seeing these XN dash dash versions of these domain names. It's really just how the system is handling them. So the parentheses below there is what the DNS can handle, and the examples above are what the user preferably should be if everything is working right. ICANN as such does not really have so much to do with what the application developers are doing, or what kind of content people are putting on websites or online. We can make recommendations and information available that you can now do this with internationalized domain names, but we can never really go to any company and force them to upgrade their products to handle these domain names. That is something that users can do if they see a need for this, and I think it's pretty obvious that need is out there. But back to the program plan. So what we want is to eventually be able to deploy IDNs. And we have a broad set of projects for that to reach that goal. I picked out just four of them, and it's just four examples, and at the end of this I'll give you like a slide with an overview of some other things that are going on as well that I didn't want to get into details about, but you can ask questions if you have any questions. So for the next little while, I'll talk a little bit about security and stability again, a little bit about user confusion and spoofing issues and how to get around those. A little bit about the technical protocol, although Patrick, who's the last speaker of the three of us, will get into a little bit more detail on that than I will, but just to mention it, and then policy issues as well. So the first one, security and stability is, and keeping the DNS secure and stable is one of ICANN's core values. It's in our operational plan, and it's in our strategic plan, and it's one of the founding principles for ICANN is to make sure that the DNS stays secure and stable. In the operational plan for this year, the fiscal year of 2006-2007, we've said that we want to introduce IDNs or internationalized labels as top-level domains as an experiment, and then learn from that experience and in the next couple of years have a deployment of IDNs at the top level. So that is what we're aiming at. The two links there, I realize I don't really know if these slides are going to be available for anybody, but if not, you can come to me if you want to take a closer look at those the plans that we have out there. So the way to make sure that the DNS stays secure and stable is for IDNs is to set up some projects. And we're setting up some projects for laboratory testing and root server testing. The laboratory test goal is to demonstrate that once we move to the live root zone test, nothing goes wrong. So really, we want to demonstrate that if we put an internationalized string in the root, or the equivalent of that, the XN dash dash version of that, if we put that into the root, then it won't have a negative impact for users of the internet. And as anything else technical, it's really difficult to prove a negative, but we can take at least some steps that will make us feel fairly reasonable certain that there are no issues and then move ahead with the root zone test. So the way that we're going to do that is first do a lab test on NS records. And NS records is the way that top-level domains are inserted in the root right now. So that SE is inserted as an NS record. There are other types of resource records in the DNS. And there's been some discussions about trying out, for example, the one that's called DNAME. And DNAME is a mapping between, if you put it in as a TLD, it's a mapping between one top-level domain to the other. We're not quite far enough to actually do some testing on that, so we'll proceed with NS record testing in order not to slow things down and then at least have an answer on how does this work for the NS records. As part of the laboratory test, we'll also proceed with some operational process testing, because obviously ICANN and IANA is really not geared towards inserting huge amounts of new top-level domains into root. And because it's been pretty much like one at a time and at a very, I don't know if I can call it slow page, but it's not something where you have huge amounts being inserted at the same time. So we'll have to do some internal verification there as well and development of some processes and working with all the parties involved in inserting new TLDs. So that will be a part of that. And once we're done, we'll move forward with the root zone test. On the laboratory test, the best news I think I have today is that we've reached an agreement with Autonomica, and they will be managing, which means designing and performing and analyzing the laboratory test for us. So that's really exciting. One of the reasons for the choices of Autonomica is the staff they have has a lot of DNS experience and expertise, and that's really what you need in order to perform this kind of lab test. The test design that they're going to be developing will be made publicly available, so if anybody feels like replicating the test, we'd very much appreciate that and getting the results, and we'll obviously posted those results online as well so that we can do comparison and everything will be completely transparent. The agreement with them shows that we're expecting to have the test results in December, so this is really good progress for reaching the goal of having a technical capability of inserting IDNs in the root. The second objective I had listed has to do with user confusion and spoofing. And in the session before this one, there was a little bit of talk about that. When you add something like IDNs to domain names, you suddenly have thousands and thousands of characters that will increase the option for somebody to register domain names for fraud purposes, because some of these characters look a lot alike. I took the old example of PayPal here because, first of all, I think it's a very obvious example, and you probably heard about it before. So the PayPal, as it's written up there on the slide, the second character is actually a Cyrillic A. And it looks, to me at least, it looks exactly like the Latin A. Or the Roman A. So you can't really see the difference, and so that's a problem, because then suddenly you have two PayPal versions, one with the Cyrillic A and one where everything is Latin. This is now not possible anymore in the generic top-level domains, because we have some guidelines that describes how the gTLD registries can implement IDNs. And one of the rules in those guidelines say that you cannot mix scripts within a label. There are some exceptions to that. For example, in Japan, where the way that their languages are working, you really have to mix scripts. But Cyrillic and Latin can now not be mixed between labels, and so you don't have that problem anymore. But there are other kinds of user confusion and user problems that and spoofing options that you really can't solve with either technical or registration policies. So there's some level of confusion that has to be solved by educating the market. I think some of that will come from ICANN, and some of it will be a registrar or a registry job to reach out to the consumers in the market. Now, it's really important that we solve these problems, because if we don't, then we're going to risk something really bad, like the browsers will enable IDNs in a way that will show the XN dash dash string, and some of them do that today as well. And as you saw, those XN dash dash strings really don't mean anything, and it doesn't really work for the user communities to see that. So we really need to work together on making sure that we solve this user confusion thing as best possible. So this is a little bit more about the guidelines. As I said, we are working on revising these guidelines. It's a set of principles that was developed back in 2003 at the same time as the IETF developed the protocol for handling IDNs. We spent some time first between the cnjptw.info.org.museum, BIS, CommonNet, .name, several of the of both the ccTLD and the gTLD registries, took the guidelines and the protocols that the IETF developed and implemented IDNs to get some good experience with it. Based on that experience, we went from version 1.0 to version 2.1. Of these guidelines, and we're continuing to develop them forward. That work is being handled by a working group with representatives from various gTLD and ccTLD registries. Carrie Karp, who will be speaking after me, is one of those individuals who's working hard on this. We had monthly meetings up towards the Morocco meeting this summer, which was an ICANN meeting, and we've now continued with biweekly meetings towards the next ICANN meeting, which is in Sao Paulo. So there's really a lot of work going on there. The future versions is going to have to do or aiming at top-level principles. So the guidelines right now are being used at the second level in domain names, and we want to have something that can be used at the top level as well. And then the other thing is we really need to move it out of this is for the gTLD registries, but not the ccTLDs. It has to be something that works for everybody. It has to be some sort of like best current practice, so that implementations, especially as we move to the top level, are being done in a little bit more coherent way to avoid some more of this confusion. And that takes me to the third topic, or the third objective, the protocol review. The protocol back that was developed in around 2003 was based on the current version of Unicode at that time. And of course, Unicode keeps expanding, so we keep having more and more characters inserted in the Unicode tables. So the protocols for IDN needs to be updated to handle some of these new characters. This is something Patrick will get a little bit more into detail with. I've listed it as an ICANN project, even though it's something that's really not managed by ICANN staff. But a lot of times when you hear people talk about ICANN, it's ICANN the community and not just ICANN staff. This protocol review is part of the operational plan for us. There was a basic framework that came out in September that talked about what are different issues that need to be solved. And part of that has to do with some things that ICANN need to take care of. Dispute management, who is, registry policies and so forth, and most of it pointing at IDNs at the top level. The fourth objective is IDN policy development. And that is something, again, that's not run by ICANN staff, but supported by ICANN staff. It's run by the two supporting organizations for the GTLDs and the CCTLDs, and then also the government advisory committee that we have in place is taking a role in that. The last face-to-face meeting they had was within the GNSO, and they met in Amsterdam in August this year. And what they agreed on was that when they're looking at a policy development process for introduction of new generic top-level domains, they also need to take in the IDN issues, because if we just open up for new GTLDs, somebody's going to come and say, well, I want XN dash dash something that then translate into some meaningful string in a local script. So IDNs is being part of that as well. There's four topics that they're looking at: whether to introduce new GTLDs, and they already said yes to that, and move forward to allocation methods, selection criteria, and contractual conditions. It's an open work, as everything else, and there's lots of open public comment periods and so forth that you can take part in if you want to take part in this policy development work. This is just a list of IDN working groups. We have the President's Advisory Committee for IDNs. Both Patrick and Carrie, that you'll hear from, are members of that. It was formed in November and last year, and initially they're tasked with making recommendations towards how to resolve some of the technical challenges on the ICANN side, not on the ITF side. There's a little bit of a difference there, but fortunately some of the people overlap and we can get some consensus in moving forward. There's the IDN-TLD registries group that I already mentioned that are working on the guidelines. The IETF and the IAB have working groups from time to time on IDNs, browser communities, GNSO, CCNSO. I mentioned some of those already. And then we see a lot of regional models popping up here and there, which is a really positive a result. I just came back from a road trip in the Middle East, talking to a lot of CCTLDs and governments out there about what we're doing. Of course, it's even more difficult for them because they're writing from right to left, which causes an additional confusion for them if they have to type in Latin characters and write from left to right, as opposed to Arabic characters typing right to left. They actually handed me a laptop with an Arabic keyboard on it and said, you know, don't worry about what kind of characters you're typing in. Here's a browser, and we'll put the cursor there in the browser line and see if you can type in something and just tell us what it is that you're typing. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm like, well, I don't really know how to type in the HTTP because it's Arabic characters, so what am I going to do? Okay. So I just started typing it in, and I'm like, and they're like, so is that the second level name, or is that the top level that you're typing there? Because, you know, we're typing right to left, and I'm looking at the screen, and I'm like all confused. So it's really difficult. You really get a sense. Of course, you understand that they need it, but you really get a sense of how badly they need this when you sit next to them with a computer like that. There was also just a meeting in Shanghai that was for registrars, and it was focused on IDNs. There's the meeting here. The next thing coming up that I'm aware of anyways is the IGF meeting in Athens by the end of this month. Then there is an Asia-Pacific TLD meeting in November. It's in Bangkok. There's a CCTLD meeting coming up again in Dubai. And there's three IDN workshops and the Sao Paulo meeting for ICANN in early December. One of the things we want to try to do to help create some little bit more outreach and communication around this is to at least set up a calendar. So we're going to try to set up an IDN calendar so people can choose between the different IDN events. I mean, you can't really run around the world like I've been doing for the last month. So we'll try to do something better on that. And this is my last slide, just a set of, like, different topics on IDNs that I didn't talk about. What happens with the protocol changes that Patrick is going to talk about a little bit more? What kind of effect does it have on registries? We have an IANA repository for IDN tables that needs to be moved forward. language script specific issues that has to be solved in the local community and not something that ICANN staff will run around and make decisions about. Disputes, what are the statistics, what does the market look like, and there's many more things, and you have a link there if you want to go check out some more stuff about it on the ICANN website. And that's it from me. Thanks.
Thank you, Tina. Is there anyone having a short question for Tina while we're waiting for Carrie to change computers, since he has such a demanding presentation?
One slide.
One demanding slide. Tina's slides will be available. You made it for me, and I see for it, so it come in the right hands. Okay, good. Our next speaker is Carrie Karp. He is the director for Dot Museum and my buddy when it comes to running the IDN Nordic, or at least Swedish model so far. He is the engine. I don't know why I am cited, because there's nothing wrong with Carrie's enthusiasm in this matter. And talking to Carrie and listen to Carrie is like having this vitamin injection once in a while. And I get a refill once or twice a month. It's really, really good. It's yours.
I approach all of... Where's this thing? How does this work? The other side, okay. Am I microphonally audible? Sort of. How about this? Any? Nothing? There we go. Okay. Now. Okay. I approach all of this from a non-technical perspective. I believe I understand the technology quite well, but again, that's not the main point for me. I work in the museum community and have for decades. And although there is a popular notion of museums as somehow maintaining the material evidence of dead cultures, that's actually not what we primarily do. We are in the business, depending on how it's described, of facilitating contact between one cultural community and another. Very often, from the perspective of metropolitan cultures, museums in big cities, calling attention to the visitors of those museums to distant cultures, but in fact there's quite a bit of community action where, way distant from the big cities, small museums are, for example, being assisted to get their message onto the internet, even if they're not physically in a position where they can access the infrastructure. And IDN is kind of one of the most significant devices that's ever been placed in our hands towards that end. Okay. And it's almost coincidental, and we also happen to have convinced ICANN that when new generic top-level domains were added to the root, that one for the museum community, a dot museum, would be there. And I think you will note during the course of the presentation that there are some really interesting opportunities that are provided with that, the intersection of TLD-ness and IDN-hood, and we'll take it from there. But since I'm approaching this from a cultural perspective, I feel obligated to show you the first slide that I show everybody that I talk to about anything relating to IDN, and that's the UNESCO notion of the significance of languages. By most estimates, there are 6,500 languages currently being spoken in the world today. Far and away, the largest number of them are spoken by very small communities, and these communities are shrinking. However, those communities can also be enormously significant for the maintenance of their immediate environment. Without exaggerating, although it's a little bit heavy-handed, the cure to cancer may very well be discovered in some plant that survives only because of some 200-strong speech community in their language contains the knowledge, enshrines the knowledge that's necessary to maintain these our neighbor, our sister species. So maintaining language diversity is a really big deal because it's identical to maintaining biodiversity, and that in turn is identical with the needs of our own species. Okay, going from that into a truly literary metaphor, we've often spoken about the difficulties in the technical context of IDN. Why is it that everybody has such a rough time understanding it? And one of the reasons is that IDN is not just domain names, it's the two forms that you saw with Tina. There's the thing that you think is a domain name, that's the name Svensson with dots over the A. But in fact, the name, as far as the domain name system is concerned, is this cryptic thing, XN dash dash. And we were looking for literary metaphor, the sublime duality of IDN. What that, might that be? And one of our colleagues, yet another one of the people on the ICANN President's Advisory Committee, Ram Mohan, said, Great Expectations, Dickens is perfect. Great Expectations is what people have for IDN. And if you've read the quote, there's this little guy named Philip Pirip, who cannot pronounce his own name, and it gets reduced to PIP, which is a convenient three-letter label, and a book was written about it, and it's one of the bestsellers of all time. So, IDN, Great Expectations. Okay. More UNESCO. At its general conference in 2003, and this actually predates WISIS, this document was drafted before this seething dissatisfaction with governments somehow feeling themselves not on an equal footing as notions of internet governance were developed. I'll be speaking about that tomorrow, so I won't go any further into that. UNESCO, in its suite of recommendations and documents preparatory to international conventions, decides that collaboration in multilingual domain names is a significant portion of the cultivation of the internet, making the digital world available to everybody in their own language, surely is most significantly a matter of preparing content in all of these languages. But that's actually kind of easy. We understand those technologies, and there is any amount of non-English content, non-ASCII character set content on the internet. Some estimates actually have the English stuff now at below 50% of the total. That's just fine, but we have the challenge in the identifier space. How, as the content space becomes ever more rich and ever more clearly reflecting multilingual diversity, linguistic diversity, how do we reflect that in the identifiers rather than just completely expunge it in the identifiers? And it's actually something of a tool in the hands of people who are trying to figure out how to reduce the amount of information that they need to look at. If you see an IDN in a language that you can't even recognize, much less understand, you see a URL that contains some sequence of characters that you don't recognize, you won't click that because the expectation is that it will take you to something that you won't be able to understand. It's the absolute inverse of the person who has a repository filled with significant Arabic material, but because it's labeled with ASCII characters, 99% of the audience completely misses it and doesn't click. So IDN is not just important for the people who need to be able to express themselves with it. It's important for the people who are actually quite happy with things the way they are, but are suffering from tremendous information glut. So it swings in all directions, okay? Here's a Swedish document. This is binding on governmental agencies, which the Swedish Museum of Natural History, where I work, is. It's not really binding on .se, IIS, simply because they're not a governmental agency. But on the other hand, they are probably expected to serve governmental agencies and make it possible for governmental agencies to do what they, by law, are required to do. And although this document is not quite legally binding, the intent is clear. And what this simply says that if an administrative system is maintained at government expense and contains names, doesn't say what kind of names, if it contains names, then it needs to support a certain character repertoire, as it's called. Okay. We've already got the OER and the accented E appears in names, and the Tysk U also are here. And you'll have to forgive me, it's wrong, it's not plus. It's not, these five things are also in the list that I'm about to show you. So the number of characters that need to be added by this directive minus these five characters is what these guys have to deliver in the short term, okay? We've got these ones, plus these ones, and then there's these ones, and a few more, and then we got that, and that's all, okay? Which in the specifically Swedish context solves a half of an important problem, okay? With these characters, we can actually fully represent the orthographic requirements of two of the officially recognized minority languages. Sweden is actually kind of interesting in terms of its language planning and its legislation about languages. Swedish itself has no particular legal standing here. Everybody uses it, so that's fine. And I think the new government actually does plan to enact legislation giving Swedish status as the language of this country. In fact, it is one of the two languages in Finland. Finland is officially bilingual, Finnish and Swedish. But again, in Sweden, Swedish has de facto but not de jure standing. However, Finnish and meänkieli do have legal standing as minority languages, and when we expand the character repertoire, we can elegantly provide people with service, IDN service, native orthographies in these two things. They get halfway through two more of the minority languages, Romani and Sami, and they do just fine with the dialects of Romi. Romani is actually a bunch of dialects, which are not all interintelligible. And Sami is not a language, it's several languages, and they are even less interintelligible. And although the ones that are used in Norway, Sweden, and Finland use Latin characters and are covered by this expanded repertoire, the Kola Peninsula has its own Sami community with its own language, and that is written in Cyrillic. So if we are going to serve the Sami, and not just the Sami that happen to live in Sweden, we have to put Cyrillic on the list. And then we have a really nice exception, and that's the final of the written minority languages in Sweden. Swedish Sign Language is also a recognized minority language, but we haven't quite figured out how that is going to manifest itself on the internet. It's actually a very serious issue, extraordinarily so, but there is as yet no Unicode support for any, there is a system for writing sign languages. But it's extremely complicated, it is not amenable to encoding the way Unicode works. And it does make a difference, and we're going to work on it, but it's external to the IDN discussion at the moment. But the final of the languages is Yiddish, which is a Germanic language. Most of you in this room would probably understand a Yiddish speaker if the intention was that you were to understand. But it happens to be written with Hebrew script, which is a very simple alphabet, but it's written right to left. And the problems that Tina mentioned, I'm having noted in the Arabic community, also affect the people who use Hebrew script, and there's actually a surprising number of languages that use it, including what's called Judeo-Arabic. So in the Arabic community, and Arabic is not a single language, it's a whole bunch of Arabics, and they are not mutually intelligible. This right-to-left issue is just of dire importance, even in little old Sweden, since Yiddish does have legal status here. It has legal status in a couple of other countries, but no country has gotten anywhere as close as Sweden has to explaining what this means. And the Swedish government, I think, is the only government currently on the planet that regularly publishes documents in Yiddish. On the election site, the information for voters in the elections last month, there was information in 22 different languages produced by the Swedish government, which is kind of amazing because the selection of those languages was obviously the legally recognized minority languages, plus all the other languages that have significant numbers of voters in this country. And in fact, the absolute largest writing communities that reside here are the ones that use Arabic and Persian. And although these use scripts based on Arabic, Arabic is enormously calligraphic. There are any number of variations that apply to it in different regional and different language contexts. And if you go to the International Library in Stockholm, which is a division of the Public Library of Stockholm, and ask them what it is that the immigrant community in Sweden most asks for, it starts with Arabic and then comes Persian. And I think actually Mandarin Chinese, which is the largest language on the planet, is number three there. So although it's not quite necessary for .se to worry about this stuff yet, One of the things that we would like to happen is that the government comes to realize that although the minority languages have been designated on the basis of clearly described principles, those principles are, or the overriding principle is, how long has this speech community been in Sweden? How deep is the history of their participation in Swedish society? They're not asking the question, who actually uses these languages in Sweden? How many people use them? And that is a very reasonable criterion. The previous administration decided to set up a new governmental agency to address these issues, and precisely this type of question was promised. We will be considering this, and I understand that the second Minister of Culture to be appointed by the current new government had a press conference earlier where it was noted that this is an important matter, but it's quite indeterminate at this point where the government is likely to take it. So this is actually an opportunity for the domain name industry to drive governmental policy rather than puffing and panting, follow it. Okay. So what we're doing in Sweden actually displays an extraordinarily wide range of all of the problems that are likely to be encountered in IDN deployment. A range of scripts, numerous languages that are spoken by recognized communities in this country, and these communities also span national boundaries. So just the situation of how do we describe Swedish? Let us assume that the guys who operate .com want to support Swedish IDN, and they want to do a good job of it. They don't want to see .com abused for this. We can use .org. That's probably even a more reasonable one. Best citizens on the internet do wish to support Swedish, do not wish Swedish to be abused in that context. At some point in all of this, there has to be documentation. What is the character repertoire necessary to support Swedish? And because Swedish doesn't have any legal standing in Sweden, we can't really decide here. Who are we to say? It does have that standing in Finland, so some collaboration with some counterpart agency in Finland toward the end of describing what is necessary for any registry that might want to support Swedish is a worthwhile project. And we can do that with all of the legally recognized minority languages. In extension, I'm sure there is an EU directive to be found somewhere that obligates national registries in member states to support the full range of EU member state languages, and oh yeah, all of the minority languages in all of those member states. And we don't really have to move very far beyond where we currently are to know that we're in a situation where IDN is not just some little add-on to Swedish language support. It's a massive administrative nightmare, I suppose, to the people who are writing administrative systems, but it's an absolute necessity in terms of cultural viability, political, well, we can almost use the word opportunity. And this is the kind of stuff that needs to be done, and whoever does it first gets all the credit. Nick SE has demonstrated its ability to note what should be done first for the PR value, if nothing else. And again, grand opportunities here. Now, the domain that we operate with its center at the Swedish Museum of Natural History, because we are a museum and because we are a natural history museum and are involved in any number of multilingual projects and have been for a century or two, we know actually an awful lot about dealing with communities that use languages that we are barely able to recognize. This IDN stuff doesn't put us in a brand new situation. What it enables us to do is codify an experience that we have that is ours on an ongoing basis. And because the two Stockholm registries, there is the .se registry and the .museum registry in town here, we are looking to see if it's possible for us to codify our experience, collate it in a manner that can be put forward, generally useful. Some other national registry finds itself in a similar position, has no idea where to start in addressing it, and if we can export what we can at least agree to call the Stockholm model now, and as our neighbor countries, at least in the Nordic region, the shared Sami interest and all of those others, Swedish itself, if we can turn this into a Nordic model, we've actually got quite an interesting tool that we can we can use. In fact, we're going to be talking about that at Natur Historisk Riksmuseet on Thursday. So if there's anybody here who thinks that's actually kind of a neat thing and is going to be around Thursday morning, find me sometime during the course of the afternoon and the evening, and I'll tell you exactly what's cooking, and you're actually quite welcome to join us. Okay. Just to give you some little idea, and this is my wrap-up, the International Council of Museums, which maintains the policies on which eligibility for Dot Museum resides, has 140 national committees. Many of them use languages and scripts other than the official languages of ICOM, which are French, English, and Spanish. And this is not just a little list illustrating scripts. Each one of these things is actually a live name. I can't click on them because that's the delight of power. Point, but nonetheless, you're looking at what all of this stuff is on a page on the web, and to the best of my knowledge and belief, it was the first richest IDN page anywhere out there, and it remains the richest IDN page out there, which at this point is actually somewhat unsettling. So the grand challenge to us, the grand challenge to ICANN, is to see to it that this kind of thing just becomes an absolutely take-it-for-granted aspect of the internet infrastructure. It becomes part of the plumbing, to use the metaphor that was used earlier. And then we will have succeeded. We'll put ourselves out of business, or we'll need to find another project, but that's just fine. There's my email address if you want to get in touch with me, and a little blurb about the IDN stuff that's going on in Dot Museum. You'll find that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wasn't this a bit overwhelming? Do you see why I need this vitamin injection once in a while to just manage to carry on? The rest of it, there is only technique. That is how Patrick used to end very hard disputes on different matters. When we have decided on how and why, then it's just techniques. Oops. So, how is it going with the technique?
There
you are. Patrick Fellström, I think you should introduce in what role you're standing here, because I can't do that for you.
Okay. So, Patrick Fellström, employed by Cisco, have been working with the internationalization of protocol. Very hard word to pronounce, actually. It's easier to spell if you just can agree whether it should be an S or a Z in the middle of the word. It's easier to spell than or pronounce than aluminium. Anyways, I've been working with internationalization of various kind of protocols since I started to work with standardization of electronic mail, and we had the need to actually use Swedish characters in the bodies of electronic mail, because from the beginning that was not really possible. So I work a lot in the ITF. I'm actually one of the co-authors of the IDN standard, so you probably should blame me if it is the case that you don't like the standard as it is. And if you don't like XN dash dash and rather wanted to have other characters, that's also my fault. So, anyways, I'm also using my own computer just because of font issues. That is actually my name in Chinese that I got from people in China, that I've been able to actually type myself on my Swedish keyboard on my Mac. Okay? So, and that is, of course, possible just because they told me how to pronounce my name, and the input mechanism for Chinese is very much like transliteration of what on an English keyboard is like how you pronounce it in. Like, and it worked. So, but it doesn't work in PowerPoint. Anyways, so what we have to remember, what you have heard both Carrie and Tina to talk about, is why we need internationalized domain names. And that is, of course, because people want to communicate. You have normal communication was with voice. We communicated very locally. It was very, very difficult to... It was very, very difficult to travel. We could not communicate with people very far away. So we developed languages. We had to have some way of communicating. So we developed, so we had local communication, we had local scripts, we had local languages. And then suddenly we got the internet and computers and stuff, and we have two problems with this. We have the internet, that means that communication is global, so people far away from each other with different scripts and different languages try to communicate. And the second problem is that we're using computers. Because the computers only do exactly what we tell them. Okay. Even though my pronunciation of words in English is not perfect and is probably not very good at all, when I write documents and standards, I have friends like Carrie, John Kenson, and others that translate my version of English into proper English, so it's actually possible to understand. But humans do understand slight mistakes in spellings and pronunciations, but computer doesn't. So what we have to remember is that on the top we have my name, and then below that we see on what some of you that send an email, they say, oh, this mail should go to paf@cisco.com. But inside the email application, that to address that is in the email header is moved into the envelope in the SMTP session. From the domain name of the envelope address, the domain name is extracted and used in the DNS lookup that lookups the MX record. You get back a host name, and then the host name in turn is looked up in DNS using an A record to get back an IP address. So this is actually the translation from my name into an IP address, all of these steps. So what is the problem? The problem is that end users map from human names into the email address, while the computers are interested in the translation from the cisco.com domain name into the host name mail.cisco.com. Two different layers in the protocol stack, and unfortunately, we have exactly the same string that is used in three different places. So the problem here is that the domain name that is used in the DNS as a unique identifier of the recipient domain is also visible to the human. If it was the case that we actually had a proper abstraction layer between the domain name system and the addresses that we were using as unique, then we would not have any problem. And I tried to build these kind of systems since around 1995. Leslie Daigle, myself, John Clance, and others have written tons of papers, but people are not interested because domain names and email addresses are good enough. So to a certain degree, I am still waiting for people to say, no, this domain name crap is really, really bad. We have to start to use directory services because that is the only thing that really can solve this problem. But okay, so we still have this crappy DNS system. We have these domain names that are visible to end users. So what about using Unicode? Well, that is a pretty tricky political decision by itself, but we have decided to, like, Unicode is a good enough character set. That's actually not everyone in the world agree on that, but we have made that decision. So can we use Unicode in DNS? Tina said, no, you cannot. And I say, yes, you can, because I'm an engineer. Because inside the DNS, you can actually transport any kind of bits whatsoever. So you can have zero-valued bytes inside the domain name in DNS. That works perfectly fine. The problem is, and that's why Tina is correct, the problem is that if you start to use, for example, null bytes in your domain names, every application in the world would crash. Because the protocols that use domain names, for example, SMTP for email, they have limitations on what octets and what characters you send. It's not the DNS, it's the protocols that use domain names. So the problem is actually not with DNS, but with email, for example, just like Tina actually said. So anyways. So one problem we have in DNS, though, is that we have not really decided what character set to use in DNS, but that's a simple decision. So anyways, and then we saw these kind of things with it. So the problem we have with DNS is that someone registered the domain example.com. What is happening is that at the time of registration, that is registered in some master authoritative, like, zone file somewhere. And you probably know this much, much better than anyone else in this conference, but I'll go through this anyways, because I like the animations on this slide. Then from the master register database, this is transferred over to the slave service, which also are, of course, authoritative. And then you have some end user over here that type in something in their computer. Something is looked up and is going to a full service resolver, which then look up things in some kind of cache, maybe non-authoritative server, which queries the slave. It goes back and comes back to the resolver. And the problem here is that we need to make sure that what the domain name holder typed in actually matches what the end user is typing in. So you have what directory services people like myself say is that you have a distributed matching problem. It is a no-brainer at all to have the same application store things in a database and read it back. There is a problem when you have one application that writes and another one that reads. That is the time when you need to have these kind of agreements. And what is even worse is that we have in DNS something that we call a delayed search problem. Because the time of registration might be 10 years back in time. So it might be the case that we register something today in a certain way using bits and ones and zeros, and then someone wants to look it up, which is a normally domain name DNS lookup, 10 years from now, and it must still work. So we need to have stability in the matching system in a distributed search directory service with delayed matching. How many applications, how many PowerPoint or Word files can you open that you created 15 years ago? He said, but I didn't use PowerPoint then, I used CorelDRAW. And then my response is, exactly. What we are building here is something that have to work over time. Okay. So we have this kind of problem with the protocols, and what we decided was to use the XN dash dash thing. So I'll go a little bit quicker. So the whole idea is that it is between the presentation layer and the communication layer you do this conversion that Tina was talking about from the Unicode string into the XN dash dash and back again. So here's an example of an input. I type F, capital F, A, combining umlaut L, blah, 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 and then apply the name prep algorithm, and I get back Fellstrom. Note lowercase f and the character A with two dots. And then I apply Unicode, and I get this XN dash dash thing, which is actually stored in DNS and used in the protocols that use the domain names. So what we have, so the overall problem is that it might be the case that two different strings in Unicode might be equal according to the rules that we are using. But it might also be the case, like Carrie showed here, that two strings that look the same might actually be different Unicode strings, and because of that, two different domain names. It would be good if we only had one of these two, because then we can actually solve the problem much easier, but we have both problems. So here's, for example, these two strings, first there, Fellstrom and Fellstrom, they are the same. But it's also the case that we have Fellstrom and Fellstrom that are equal today because of the case sensitivity. So we have tried to design iDNA so it doesn't change the DNS rules regarding case insensitivity. But that was not easy, and of course it doesn't really work. A similar example to the one that Tina did with PayPal. You have the Cyrillic small letter IE and Latin small letter E, which actually looks very much the same. It's actually the same font. Lushida Grand Regular, 72 points, but these two characters there to the right. And they look very much the same. Of course, it's a font issue, but what is not a font issue? So there might also be some other kind of, like, what is it, we also have to remember that what is a domain name and what is stored in the zone file are two different things. And then here is something, the first thing, I think, which a registry, etc., in their contracts need to make really, really sure here that it's crystal clear what is registered. Is it the Unicode string? Is it the string in some other character set that is translated to Unicode? Or is it the Unicoded ASCII version that is registered? Might be kind of interesting to know if you have a dispute resolution process that has to take care of these kind of things. And how do you handle trademark infringement things? Is it the case that you say that, oh, people want to register Fellstrom.sc, but it's actually XN dash dash blah 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 that is registered in the zone file. Does that imply that registration of XN dash dash FLTST is not a trademark infringement on Fellstrom if that was a trademark? So you have to be a little bit careful there. So an example here is that someone wanted to register Fellstrom, and then you have that thing in the zone file. Someone type in capital F, A, blah, blah, umlaut, and when you decode, you see something else. And this is also something that might confuse the user, that the rules we have today already convert some Unicode string into something else. So it might be the case that you see some kind of weirdnesses. Okay, so what has happened, so that was the history. So what has happened in the current status? Internet Architecture Board released a document, RFC 4690, on IDN issues that lists a number of issues with IDNs. This document, I started this when I was on the Internet Architecture Board, but finished it, like, after. So John Kenz and myself, I'm Terry, you're also co-author of this document, yes. And there is, this is an outcome from some IEB discussion and other kind of discussions. So let me just, you can read this document and see what the actual issues are, but here's the summary. First of all, people think of words as in the form of languages. So the question with language rules is, for example, if you look at Swedish, Norwegian, and German or something, for example, should O with two dots match an O slash or maybe an O? Is it the case that variants, which is aliases at the time of registration, would that solve this problem? And if it is the case that it is a policy only at the point time of registration, what should applications do that try to help the users? How is Firefox supposed to implement variant policy issues to help the end user? Should the policies be published in a machine-readable format so applications should be able to apply them at the time when in the user interface? No idea. Really, really hard problem. And then you have this problem with multiple scripts, that manuscript uses glyphs that look similar. Latin, Cyrillic, and Greek is one example from our part of the world. Many languages can be expressed in multiple scripts, which is another problem. For example, many of the Asian or African languages can be expressed both in their own local script, but also in Latin script. Vietnamese, for example, is very often written in Latin script. Should there be matching between the Vietnamese word in Latin script and the Vietnamese word written in their own script? Should that be the same? Should we force the registrant to register like multiple domain names? And then you have these equivalence algorithms that the Unicode consortium define. The normalization algorithms that they have try to compensate for all of these kind of problems, but as you know, as you can see when you read these documents, they have not really been able to solve the problem, which is not surprising because it's very, very hard. And on top of being problematic and impossible to create good normalization rules, it is also the case that the normalization rules that Unicode Consortium have do have bugs, which means that the normalization rules, in a very few cases, extremely rare, not used very often, but still, there are incompatible normalization rules between the various versions of Unicode. So when you upgrade an operating system from one to another one, it might be the case that the version of Unicode changes and the normalization rules changes. And then remember what I said, that the matching rules must be stable over time, over a very long time. The next thing, which is very close to the problem with matching characters and language forms, that has to do with URIs in printed form. We see this as a very special problem, that many Unicode strings might look the same, but in reality they are different. What happens if you have something that really looks like a slash, but it's actually part of a domain name? Very, very popular to use these kind of things, so that people want to use these kind of things for various phishing problems. It might also be the case that some of the glyphs in Unicode are actually trademarks. Should we prohibit those? Or should only the trademark holder be able to use it? Should we leave to the trademark holders to dispute the registrations? I have no idea. And then, of course, we have font issues, that there are certain fonts which uses curls even on Latin characters, so they look very much like Thai. So we even have homograph problems across scripts just because of the selection of glyphs. Okay, and if this doesn't scare you, okay, bidirectional text. Like we heard Tina try to type in a URL in Arabic. Should you start with HTTP or should it end with PTTH? Like, what is the direction of the URI? Is that right to left? Or is it left to right if it is the case? Oh, sorry. Is it left to right or is the direction of the URL right to left if the majority of the labels are right to left? Okay. Kerry just told me that we had a discussion with Martin Duris that it has been working with the internationalized URIs. And his response was, oops, we better have to reopen that discussion as well. So at least there is a common understanding that this really is a problem. For example, if we have a domain name, 1 right to left, 2 right to left, should that be written as lotr2.lotr1? In reality, one of the findings we have is that we have to start to talk about network order of characters as compared to display order. And all of you that are programmers that I've been talking about, like network byte order and those kind of things, this is exactly the same thing. We need to agree on what is the order the characters are sent over the network, and then the display order is something different. And then HTTP is, of course, always in Latin. I have no idea how to solve this. And then, of course, we have the new version of Unicode that I mentioned. We have some small changes there. But will application libraries know this? I saw the other week when I actually wrote some software in Unicode to software in Perl, I saw that the different subversions of Perl actually uses different versions of Unicode. So depending on what Perl version you have, on my FreeBSD box, I got different results when working with domain names. That is not very fun. So what is happening? As Tina, we have this RFC that I 4690, I think. But we have continued to work in the IETF arena with these kind of things. And Carrie, Tina, Harald Algestrand, John Kenzie, and myself have been working together the last couple of months. We have met a few times, and we just released a couple of drafts. I think three of them are pretty important. The first one, Kerry Karp and John Kenson has written a specific document that talks about the general issues with IDNA. And IDNA is the protocol format that implements IDN. So that is a good document to read on what kind of issues do we really have to try to solve when we're coming up with a new version of IDN. The second document by Harald Alvestrand and Kerry talks about the issues with bidirectional text. Because in the current version of IDNA that I was helping to write, we actually do a lot of hand-waving with bidirectional text. And one of the reasons why we choose to do a lot of hand-waving is that the current IDN is based on Unicode version 3.2 that didn't specify much about bidirectional text at all. And we didn't want to invent anything in the IETF. Now in version 5, it's better, so I think it's possible to solve. And then a draft that I have written myself, which is extremely long, I think 90-plus pages, but most of it is actually part of the Unicode tables. What I'm trying to do is to try to explain why it's hard to select what code points to use from Unicode, for example, if you're a registry. What code points should you allow? What code points should you not allow? So it doesn't come with any suggestions, but it's just a basis for discussion to show that, well, personally, I don't think that we have enough data to be able to do a clean selection process unless we are picking code, going code point by code point, which is not a good thing. And then the last thing, which we have to remember, which Tina mentioned as well, is that this is not really a DNS problem, because the algorithms that we're using for DNS, we can solve those, leave that to us engineers, we'll just come up with the right solution. People like Kerry and Michael Everson and some others, they will pick the code points, that's fine. You can use, like Kerry explained, the definitions you have in various cultures and countries on what characters and languages are minority languages. So that selection process and stuff, that's also pretty simple. The hard part are all the protocols that use domain names. And one of the most difficult things that I also heard from many of you, why do people not want to register internationalized domain names? Well, it's just because they cannot use internationalized email addresses. And that is, of course, because the left-hand side of the @ email address cannot be anything else than US ASCII. Not until people can use their own characters also on the left-hand side, before that we will not see any real use for IDNs. So the IETF has had since a while back the EAI working group in the IETF, and they have a couple of proposals, a couple of implementations do exist on how to handle internationalized local parts of email addresses. I'm pretty hopeful myself that we will see, that we actually will see at least agree on one direction to move forward. And there are many implementers of email software that actually really, really want to implement this, both on the email server side and also on the client side. And now since Eudora is open source together with Thunderbird, Eudora merge, I have pretty good hope that Steve Dorner and the others will also solve that problem. I think that's, yeah. That's it. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Any questions? I suggest that you, all speakers, come forward and take a seat. First of all, I think it's a real blessing that we as a registry are the ones who decide what scripts will be allowed in .se, since this is really, really hard. And we have had some questions during the last weeks, like, why don't you just do it, you know, all the IDN? And you have to remember, when you let something loose, it's very hard to take it back. So we are very careful when we're doing this process, but we are anxious to get this minority language represented in .se when we're ready for it, actually. So, any questions?
Okay.
You start.
No, I thought we could leave. No, I'm sorry.
Any answers?
Yes.
You can have the microphone.
Do you see any limitations with the current DNS standard in terms of, you know, maximum number of allowed characters in domain names when it comes to IDN?
Yes. Next question. The length of the label, of course, is a problem. It can today be maximum 63 octets in a label. And this means, of course, that if it is the case that you have a Unicode string that is the label, it is the length of the string after you apply Unicode that can only be 63 octets. Okay. So this, of course, means that there are certain terms in other languages which also, in some cases, use very, very long strings in scripts that will end up in very long strings. Okay, there are two answers to this. First of all, the trial that Tina was talking about, the lab test that Autonomic is doing, it is very explicitly part of that to test what is happening if it is the case that the string is exactly 63 octets. And also see what is happening if it is 64. Do we see any problems in the current resolver implementations if it is the case that we run over? Do we get any weird buffer overflows? Do we get any weird problems with the compression algorithm in the DNS, for example? That's one part of the answer. The second thing is that we actually were thinking about this sort of when we designed the Unicode algorithm, because one of the reasons why we did not reuse an encoding algorithm like UTF-8 but ASCII is just because we thought that many of the labels will be sort of from the same script or the same block in Unicode, which means that all the code points in the same label would be very close to each other in the Unicode character set. So the way the encoding algorithm is used is that it favorizes string which have octets which are close to each other in Unicode code block. So if it is the case that you have all Chinese characters, but then suddenly one Thai character, then the length will increase much, much more than if you just have Chinese characters. So we were thinking about, like, the design of that, and we're hoping that people are using code points which are close to each other. So having code points in Unicode close to each other in the Unicode table will make it possible to have longer labels in the local script than if you don't.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, of course.
Because the other part of the length of a domain name has to do with how the applications are handling it. And ISPs are allowing for longer strings, and it's something that the existing GTLD operators are looking at, because when we started having COMNET and ORG, it was 3 characters, and then more came around, and that created some problems for especially those that picked more than 3 characters. But also even just that .biz had problems with that, even though it's 3 characters. So that's another half of it that is just at a different layer in the DNS.
I have something to add to it, might as well. The minimum length of a Unicode string is 7 characters. That's the 4-character prefix overhead, and anything that's encoded requires at least 3 octets. So there's actually a very unpleasant situation in particularly the .com space where single label second level domains are, sorry, single character second level domain names are not permitted. But there are, I mean, I've been able to find more than a half a dozen things that look like O.com, and each and every one of them is some other thing in the Unicode code chart that happens to look like an O, and because it is seven octets that is being registered, that gets around the policy constraint. I mean, it's what Patrick was talking about, what exactly is being registered. So there's a tremendous mismatch now between the policy framework, which assumes that we are talking about ASCII only, both displayed and stored, and what we're getting into, where display and storage are two entirely different things.
Any further questions?
I have this issue about when we're internationalizing everything and using multiple languages. When we're internationalizing everything and using multiple languages at the same time, it's very likely that we're going to have words that collide in meaning and in respect of racial expressions and things like that.
It is not possible, just on the protocol level, to recognize language. That we can deal with scripts because the Unicode code chart is divided in a manner that allows us to recognize them. The way these scripts are used for writing languages, representation of actual words, resists any form of algorithmic treatment. And it is also not reasonable to expect there to be any human recognition of all possible synonyms between one thing that a word in one script and something that looks exactly the same but means something entirely different than another. So the numbers of let me back up. It is the following statement is probably true. There are no new problems that are introduced with IDN. The problem you're talking about already exists. But all of the problems that are causing us current difficulty will cause us a lot more difficulty with IDN, and some things that are not problematic at present will become problematic because of IDN. But no brand new kind of problem other than that, I think, is likely.
No, it's not a new problem. It's just it's going to expand.
Yes, yeah. And the question is how many orders of magnitude that increase is going to be.
And one other thing that I didn't point out in my presentation is that in reality there are not many operating systems and applications that actually use Unicode internally. So in the display ahead, when you take the string that I suppose that I just took for granted was in Unicode and do the Punicodification of it, it's actually the case that many local operating systems, in reality, to get the best result for the end user, use some kind of local script and local font and local everything. So you first have a translation into to and from Unicode that also can create some problems.
And that is why we think that the translation should be done between the registrant and the registrar, because they have to agree, I as a registrant, I must be sure that my registrar register what I actually want to register, you see, because on the registry level, we have lost it already. It's gone. The meaning of what I want to express is gone on the way. So, what did I say? No more questions? Because if not, I will... Okay, we have one.
It's to Patrick first, I think. You mentioned there's a problem with using IDNs in email addresses.
There's a problem with the local part in email addresses. You can of course use international domain names on the right hand side of that sign, yes.
How much time do you think it takes for IETF to resolve these issues in the email protocols and other protocols that is affected in similar manners?
Well, I think 7 years ago or something on the Internet Organon, I said that DNSSEC will be deployed in 6 months. And this is like sort of deployed now.
Sort of.
So it took 7 months, and 7 years and not 6 months.
Dog years.
I'm a person that is optimistic, and just because I saw at the last IETF there were some demonstrations of some implementations, of course some implementations that demonstrated that some proposals were completely wacky and didn't fly. I see a lot of interest from people to participate and try to hammer out the problems, especially from people in Asia. So I really, really hope that we at least have only one possible path forward, and then the only question is, what will the details of the standard look like? But it might take another half a year or something before we really have that. But to be able to reach that, it is really important that people participate, they are active on the mailing list, and they try to implement stuff. So I encourage everyone here in Sweden, and especially in the Western world, that are absolutely... There are not many people that actually are visible in the IETF from the Western world that to participate in this internationalization of email addresses. And just in the, so the only way of speeding it up is to help. So please do.
And when we have this protocol, how far will it be from everyone to change their email client?
That, of course, will take some time because there are two things. You need to upgrade the email client, and then, first of all, the email client need to be implemented, and then people have to change it. We saw with the Internet Explorer, and of course, Microsoft is a dominant implementer. We saw that Internet Explorer, we got IDN in it like last week.
Yes.
And the standard was ready like quite some time ago. So sometimes it takes quite a long time.
Okay. I don't know what time is it. I'm sorry, I lost my watch.
10 to 5.
10 to 5. We still have 10 minutes. No one?
Oh, here, more questions. One more there.
Raise your hand again.
We only talked about emails so far. How many other of the standard protocols do have issues?
I think one of the largest problems probably is in the security side, where I think people need to do some kind of revision of the X509 standard and talk about what is actually supposed to be used there. So it might be the case that in the X509 standard and the LDAP directory protocols, which have very much to do with the identities, I think that's the only other part where we need to review the protocols and just make sure, do we anywhere expose the actual Unicode characters, or do the protocols only handle Unicode internally or not? And that work has started, but it's not finished. So I think we need to do something there. The other place where we need to do some kind of changes. I think the email address is probably the most important one, because if you think about what people have on their business cards, we talk about the URI to their web page and the email address, because it has to do with the strings which are domain names which are displayed to humans, and what was printed in ads on side of buses. Those are the ones we need to fix. So if we manage to fix the email address and the normal web URI, I think we're done for a while. Then we can see a major deployment.
I mean, there's an extension to that, and that is the real significance of IDN may not be in the online environment, but it's clearly on the external media environment. Someone reading an article in pick your language that is not written with language with Latin characters. Coming to a URI and seeing that in Latin is going to assume that, okay, I don't understand English, this is not relevant to me. But if that script sequence is recognizably their language, then they will proceed. I mean, if it's someone who hasn't used the internet, they'll find the nearest teenager and say, can you please try this? This looks interesting. So the signals that are given offline for the purposes of attracting people into the online environment really do have to be given in vernacular. So the network users' traditional familiarity with Latin for protocol identifiers or in URIs, that's great. We're trying to migrate away from that. But the most dramatic, significant effects that we're going to be seeing from the internationalization of the identifier space is as they appear in the offline media, where there is no tradition of Latin being intermingled with some other script.
And that this is one of the reasons why I personally think that being able to have internationalized version of the top-level domain, which is like all the labels, are so important, because you need to be able to write something in just the local script. Because the only problem we then have is the dot, which actually is a bigger problem than people might think, but then we only have a problem with that one.
Well, and we have the problem with the HTTP.
Right. Yeah, with HTTP, but in many of the applications, people don't have to type that
right at
the moment because we're lucky enough to have one dominant protocol.
Yeah. I'm just making sure nobody in the room thinks that we'll avoid the HTTP.
That's a question. Over there.
A little bit louder, Lua, and I can repeat the question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Protocols like SIP or the protocols we use for Yabber or other, or that they just follow. Once we solve the internationalization,
okay,
one time, we actually solved it for all the protocols.
Okay, maybe I was a little bit naive. Very good question. The question Lou asked was, okay, so how come I only say that email and the web are important and not, for example, SIP or Jabber addresses or XMPP addresses? You're absolutely right. They are also important. But I don't see – there are two reasons why I didn't point them out. One, I don't see as big deployment on, for example, business cards as I would like, for example. Like Carrie points out, it's on the paper thing, that is the important thing. But the second thing is that both SIP addresses and Jabber addresses very much look like and work like email addresses. Or both syntactically by itself, but also in the protocols, they work very much similar to the way we handle email. So I hope, once again, I might be too optimistic, that when we have a solution or a path forward for email addresses, we can reuse the same kind of ideas in SIP and Jabber and other email-like things. So, but it's a combination of those two, why I don't think really those two are needed before we see a larger deployment, but of course you have tons of protocols where we need to review this. The reason why I pointed out X509 as more important is just because if it is the case that you open a web browser and you have an SSL session that is going to open, you have a certificate, then suddenly the common name normally in the certificate is displayed to the user. And the user is supposed to decide whether should I go to that website or not. So it is a security human visibility issue with the contents of the certificate. And that's why I think that's important. And just because it has to do with security, I claim that is more important than the protocols that are not as deployed as SIP and Jabber. But of course, they have to be reviewed.
Okay, I think we end by now. And thank you to the speakers. Thank you for your patience.